What are the apparitions of Fatima?
They were a series of apparitions of the Mother of God to three Portuguese children in the little, near the little village of Fatima in the year 1917, towards the end of the First World War.
But aren't apparitions in general bogus, simply being part of the superstitions of backward people?
That's certainly a modern scientific way of looking at it, or pseudo-scientific way of looking at it. But in fact, the Mother of God has appeared to privileged souls all down the ages, ever since she appeared to St. James, the Greater in Spain, and Saragossa in the very earliest days of the Church. All down the history of the Church ever since, she has appeared whenever there has been need in order to encourage the faithful, to guide them, to enlighten them, to strengthen them, to console them, to lead them. And Fatima, the apparitions of Fatima in 1917 are an outstanding example of her fulfilling this motherly role of guiding and leading her children to heaven, because we are all of us her children.
Let's go into some of the details of the Fatima apparitions. Who were the seers at Fatima?
The seers at Fatima were three little Portuguese children about the age of 6, 7, 8, or 7, 8, 9, two girls, Lucy and Jacinta, and a little boy called Francisco. That, of course, is the fact that quite often Our Lady appears to children is another reason why the modern mentality mocks apparitions. The Mother of God does also appear to adults, but she often chooses children, no doubt for their innocence and for their docility, because they will be perfectly docile instruments of heaven and because they're perfectly innocent. But that's no reason to pour scorn on the apparitions. In fact, every time there are genuine apparitions of Our Lady, there are plenty of phenomena and miracles which are scientifically testable and measurable, and which the most atheistic of scientists have got no explanation for. They're bound to recognize the facts, and they've got absolutely no explanation. Well, the Catholic has a very easy explanation. These are miracles obtained from God, by the Mother of God, in order to prove that it really was she who appeared to whoever it was.
Now, could you say a little bit more about the three children, going through each one of them?
Lucy, they were all three very natural and normal little Portuguese shepherd, peasant children, if you like, out in the middle of the country, as it then was. It's now, of course, a great shrine, a great Marian shrine. But then it was a little Portuguese village, indistinguishable undoubtedly from thousands of others. Jacinta and Lucy are very natural little children. Lucy loved to sing and Jacinta loved to dance. Francisco and Jacinta were brother and sister, and Lucy was a cousin of Francisco and Jacinta.
Of the three, is only Lucy still living?
Francisco and Jacinta died quite soon after the apparitions. I think Francisco died in 1919 and Jacinta, I think, in 1920. And in the short space of time that elapsed after the apparitions, they both the little children undoubtedly became great saints. And I think their tombs were opened recently and their bodies were discovered incorrupt, and their beatification is now, the process of their beatification is underway. They died early. Lucy is still alive. She must be now, of the order of 80 years old. She is still living. She is a Carmelite in the Carmel of Coimbra in Portugal. And Our Lady said to Lucy at the apparitions that her son wanted Lucy to stay and give witness to the Immaculate Heart, which is what she's done down all these decades, ever since the apparitions themselves. Heaven has regularly, the Mother of God or Jesus himself, have regularly spoken to Lucy and told her another message, given her another message for someone in the Church or for the Pope or whoever. And so, actually, ever since the apparitions, Lucy has continued to be a messenger, and this is the function which probably even today she's still fulfilling.
Could you very briefly relate the series of events at Fatima? Unfortunately, we will not be able to go into them to their full extent, but maybe you could sketch the general outline.
Very briefly, Our Lady appeared six times in succession on the 13th of each month, from May the 13th through to October the 13th, inclusively, of 1917. Her first apparition was like introductory. The 3rd in July was very important because that was when she revealed to the three children the famous secret of Fatima in three parts. It's one secret in three parts, but it's usually referred to as the first, the second, and the third secret of Fatima. The first two secrets we know, the third secret has still not been revealed, although it should have been revealed in 1960. In August, the apparition was not on the 13th, but on the 19th, because the Freemasons were getting very upset, and they caught hold of the children and imprisoned them on the 13th, and so Our Lady had to come back a few days later. The series of apparitions concluded on October the 19th with the stupendous, October the 13th, concluded on October the 13th with the stupendous miracle of the sun, whereby a crowd of 70,000 who'd gathered so numerous because there was a promise of a miracle, all witnessed a stupendous dance of the sun in the sky, whereby it span around like a firework and shot off all different colors. Finally, it seemed to crash down towards earth, and the whole crowd was crying out in fear and panic, and then at the very last moment it seemed to turn around and go back, take its place in the sky, and resume its normal appearance. That was the great miracle of the sun. There's never been any miracle so great predicted to happen at exactly such a moment, and which in fact happened. And it was obviously heaven's way of proving beyond any doubt to the most arrogant of pseudo-scientists or atheists or whoever you will, a way of proving to them that the whole apparitions were absolutely authentic.
Well, I understand that there were a great number of conversions as a result of that great miracle.
Yes, and there was a wave of Catholicism which swept through Portugal following on the apparitions, and which revived the faith in Portugal in an extraordinary way.
Did these apparitions also have an impact on the political life of Portugal?
Yes. The Freemasons had been dominating, the bitter enemies of the Church had been dominating Portuguese politics for 150 years, more or less since the Napoleonic Wars. And the Masons lost power soon after Fatima because there was just an upsurge of popular feeling and faith from the grassroots, which meant that the people wouldn't stand for the Freemasonic nonsense any longer. And within a few years, there rose to power a marvelous Catholic ruler, head of state, Dr. Salazar, Dr. Oliveira Salazar. And he ruled Portugal not as a dictator, as our miserable liberal newspapers say, nor as a fascist, but simply as a Catholic. And he guided the destinies of Portugal with very great wisdom and with very great faith from the middle of the 1920s, the late 1920s, right through to his death in the 1970s. It was an extraordinary gift of God, and it was deserved, it was merited by the Portuguese people insofar as they reacted so well to the apparitions, and they responded to the grace of the apparitions of Fatima.
In the Fatima message, Our Lady related a great secret to the children consisting of three parts. What was this first secret?
The first secret was the vision of hell. Fatima gets right back to basics, and the basic of basics is the eternal destiny of souls and the fact that each soul must go for eternity to heaven or to hell. And she revealed to the little children a terrifying vision of hell. The children saw her hands like outstretched, and rays of light seemed to descend from her hands into the earth, and the earth like opened up, and they saw like an ocean of fire, with souls being tossed up like sparks in a great bonfire, and falling weightless back amidst the most horrible shrieks and yells, amidst black demonic shapes, transparent with fire, in the most terrible pain. And this vision of hell made a tremendous impression on the three little children. the two of them that died soon after, in the couple of years that God gave them life, they did tremendous penance, just in order, said little Jacinta, who was so young, just in order to save souls from hell. And Lucy undoubtedly also did so. And that's why those, the photographs of the children at the time of the apparitions look so serious and so sad, because they've been struck by this vision of hell, no doubt.
Yet today, modern theologians scoff at this idea of hell.
Well, modern theologians are just, they've lost the faith. I mean, they've got no notion of what Catholicism is about. Of course hell exists. It's the most terrifying fact. It corresponds to the justice of God. God is not mocked, and when we fool around with an almighty God, as we do with our sins, hell is the proportionate punishment. But of course, if you don't believe in sin, of course you won't believe in hell, because if you don't believe in sin, why should anybody be punished? What's anybody got to be punished for? So it's a loss of faith in God, a loss of faith in sin, and a loss in that produces a loss of faith in hell. But hell exists. There's absolutely no doubt about it. It's obvious.
The idea of suffering eternally in hell is a very terrifying one. And I understand that Our Lady has provided us with the means of avoiding eternal damnation through the Fatima message. What are these means?
That is the stupendous offer of the Immaculate Heart in 1925. After the apparitions, 6 years after the apparitions, she appeared, actually her son appeared to Lucy in the convent where she then was. It wasn't yet the Carmel, but it was a convent. And he revealed to Lucy his desire that the world should practice, the Catholic should practice the devotion of the five first Saturdays. And the great promise attached was that whoever would, on the first Saturday of five successive months, go to confession, receive communion in the state of grace, meditate for 50 minutes on the rosary, any or all of the mysteries of the rosary, and pray five mysteries of the rosary, anyone who would do those four things on five successive first Saturdays would go to heaven, has the promise of receiving all the grace they need at the hour of death in order to go to heaven. It's a stupendous promise. It's comparable only to the great promise of the Sacred Heart of the nine first Fridays, which is, I think, confession and communion, or even just communion in a state of grace, on the first Friday of nine successive months. In the 20th century, God has made it easier, even easier, by cutting it back to 5 months. You only have to make the five first Saturdays. But if anyone who makes the five first Saturdays is pretty sure of going to heaven.
And there again, you have modern theologians scoffing at this, saying it's a bunch of formulas of superstitious people. That's
well,
one of the themes that runs through Fatima, is people of the modern world ridiculing and scoffing many of the ideas that come out of the apparition.
These are people that have lost the faith and lost all sense of the faith. If they had the faith or had the sense of the faith, they would remember the Sacred Heart guaranteeing salvation for anyone who made the nine first Fridays. Catholicism is objective. It's not just feeling, feeling, feeling like Protestantism. It's objective. Here is this measurable, clear, simple fact of doing these four things on five Saturdays. If you score 20 out of 20, you will go to heaven. That's Catholicism. It's simple, it's clear, it's humble, it's solid, it's objective. If you do what heaven asks, you will go to heaven.
Have Catholics in general made use of these means of getting to heaven?
Certainly not enough, according to, for instance, Lucy. Lucy, when the devotion was revealed to her in 1925, she was, you know, within a few years or so, she was disappointed that more people hadn't picked it up and picked the ball up and run with it, so to speak. But probably even today, Catholics still aren't taking Fatima seriously enough. I mean, any Catholic who knows about the five first Saturdays and hasn't done them needs his head examining. After all, what's Catholicism if not the desire to go to heaven and the struggle to go to heaven, the fight to go to heaven? And here we have it offered to us in the most simple and practical way. A Catholic who doesn't do the five first Saturdays is crazy, but again, because of a lack of faith, a diminishing of the faith, there aren't all that many Catholics, maybe, who have done the five first Saturdays.
There is a great mystery here. We have this vision of hell, which is so terrifying. And the other terrifying part of it is that you spend all of eternity there. Yet, many individuals, and I'm sure we're all culpable, for the sake of a few more pleasures here on earth, throw away our salvation.
Well, that's a great mystery. It's the devil who succeeds in deceiving men and dangling in front of our eyes like trinkets and gewgaws the fleeting pleasures of this life. And we go for those pleasures which he dangles in front of our eyes, and we lose the eternal happiness of heaven. It's incredible, it's impossible to understand, but it happens all the time. It's the mystery of iniquity.
Moving on here, what was the second secret told by Our Lady?
The second secret was a prophecy. And Our Lady spoke of Russia. She spoke of the consecration of Russia to Her Immaculate Heart, the communion of reparation of the first Saturdays of the month. And she said that if people did what she asked for, then there will be peace and the First World War would come to an end. But if they continue to offend God, then under the reign of Pius XI, another war would start. And she said that when you see a night lit up by an unknown light, realize that it is the great sign that God is giving you that he is going to punish the world for its crimes by means of war, famine, and persecutions against the Church and the Holy Father. In order to prevent that, I shall come and ask for the consecration of Russia to my Immaculate Heart and the communion of reparation of the first Saturdays of the month. If people listen to my requests, heed my requests, Russia will be converted and there will be peace. Otherwise, she will spread her errors throughout the world, provoking wars and persecutions against the Church. The good will be martyred, the Holy Father will have a great deal to suffer, and many nations will be annihilated.
Has this prophecy come to fulfillment, that Russia would spread its errors throughout the world?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, Nicaragua has gone communist. The communists are hard at work in South Africa, in Chile, in the Philippines, in the few countries that haven't yet gone communist. America, in its thinking, the United States of America is largely communist because of the miserable liberal newspapers which are so vigorously promote communism, in fact, and undermine any anti-communism. Communism is making leaps and bounds forward throughout the world, and yet I was back in England talking to quite an intelligent man recently, and I said, you know, that Our Lady prophesied communism would advance, and he said to me, well, then she was wrong, wasn't she? As though communism is not advancing, and there he is, completely blind and totally unable to see just how communism is advancing. It's leaping forwards, with apparently nothing to stop it.
I think one has to clarify an item here. One doesn't have to have the Communist Party come to power for communist ideas to become present in a nation.
Right.
And I see this in my own country, Canada. You have the beginnings of freedom of speech being suppressed.
Yeah. That's it. I suppose that's how this person in England also was deluded. He thinks that if you've got liberals and Democrats in power, then they're nowhere near communists. But in fact, large numbers of liberals and Democrats are three-quarters communist in their thinking. It's very sad, but communism is winning, even where, as you say, the Communist Party is not in power. It's just triumphing everywhere.
Well, in the English-speaking world, most of the Communist parties are jokes, but the ideas are still spreading.
Certainly.
If you take Marx's 10 points,
yeah,
half of them have been implemented to some extent in most of the English-speaking world.
That's right. And people think that there's a reaction taking place against communism and so on, but the basic principles of communism are still triumph, because communism is simply atheism in action, crusading atheism. That's really what it is. And most of your liberals and Democrats are atheistic. It's sad to say so, but they think authority comes from the people. They don't think authority comes from God, and many of them don't believe in God. And that's why they are sitting ducks for communism. They're doing communism's work without the communists having to do it for themselves.
What is the solution to stop Russia from spreading these errors?
Well, there's only one solution, and that is that the world should be consecrated to... that Russia should be consecrated to the Immaculate Heart of Mary by the Pope in union with all the bishops of the world in a solemn act of reparation. That's the only way to stop Russian communism. And the reason is because Our Lady said so. Now, her son is not going to make a liar out of his mother. And so if he allowed her to come down to earth and say, either you consecrate the world to my heart, either you consecrate Russia to my heart, or Russia will spread its errors throughout the world, then the only way, the one and only way to stop Russia spreading its errors throughout the world, is perfectly clear, is to consecrate Russia to the Immaculate Heart.
But we see from Fatima that communism is largely a spiritual problem. Does this perhaps explain, let's say, why political attempts by leaders such as Winston Churchill or President Reagan now to stop communism have failed?
Absolutely. The Westerners are very short-sighted. They are trying to fight communism with liberalism, which is like trying to put out a fire by pouring gasoline on it. Liberalism works absolutely in the sense of communism because the liberals share the deep-down principles of communists. Those deep-down principles are no truth that I don't like and no law that I don't like. I'm going to make my own truth and make my own law. Those principles are shared by liberals and communists, and God is nowhere. And the result is that liberals and communists defy God, and they both got to be punished. Liberals are punished by falling into communism, and communists are punished by producing hell on earth. And that's the way the most of the world today is headed. And it is a spiritual problem of defying God, of thinking you can do without God, of just thumbing your nose at God. It's a spiritual problem, and it's only got a spiritual solution.
Another great mystery is inside the church you have this communism which is against God, yet inside the church you have all these communists.
Because these churchmen have lost their faith. They've lost their Catholic faith. Now, Catholicism is a crusade. You have got to go and win the world. Our Lord said so. You've got to convert the world. You've got to win souls and save souls. Every Catholic is a natural crusader. When, therefore, you lose the faith and you've still got these crusading habits, you've got to go crusading for something else. And you look around for what people still believe in, and materialistic people do believe in the goals of communism, making the third world happy, you know, big national product, and so on and so on. I mean, all these materialistic goals the communists believe in. So your crusading churchmen, having lost the Catholic faith, or in effect lost it, they feel they have to go for these materialistic goals. And when they start going for these materialistic goals, which is a crusade everybody still believes in, making plenty of wells in India and so on and so on, when you go for those materialistic goals, you find yourself, without realizing it, perfectly in synchro with communism. And then you suddenly find that the communists are promoting the same things that you are, that they support you, that they encourage you. The communists will always encourage you if you're falling away from God. They support you and they encourage you, and you suddenly find your greatest friends in the world are communists. Before you know you're in their camp, and you're a communist yourself. That's how it happens. It's a loss of faith, a lack of prayer, and a loss of faith.
Has the Vatican ever properly heeded Our Lady's request to consecrate Russia to her Immaculate Heart?
To this day, no. Ever since the Mother of God revealed this request to Lucy in Tuy, spelled T-U-Y, which again was a convent where Lucy was, ever since this great vision of the Holy Trinity and of the cross and of the Mother of God was revealed to Lucy in 1929, which is when the need to consecrate Russia to the Immaculate Heart was revealed, that consecration by the Pope and the bishops of the world in a solemn act, consecrating Russia to the Immaculate Heart and making an act of reparation, that has never been done.
But there have been, let's say, attempts at the consecration in 1942, in the 1950s, and most recently by John Paul II in 1984. What have all of these lacked?
Well, the popes have not done exactly what the Mother of God asked for. For instance, Pope Pius XI, in 1930, he knew of the message. It was taken to him. He knew of the request very soon after the request was made in 1929 through Lucy. The Pope knew of it in 1930, and he did nothing, Pope Pius XI, because he thought he knew better how to handle the communists. In 1937 again, even immediately after he'd written his great encyclical against communism, because by then he'd understood that you can't talk Turkey with communists, even in 1937, immediately after his great encyclical Divini Redemptoris, he still didn't carry out the act of consecration of Russia to the Immaculate Heart. In 1942, Pope Pius XII, who was a lot more sympathetic to Fatima than was Pius XI, in 1942, when the war was raging, the Second World War was raging, Pope Pius XII carried out a consecration of the world to the Immaculate Heart, but not of Russia. He made a disguised reference to Russia in the consecration of 1942. He spoke about a land in which the Mother of God's icons are hidden and are waiting for better days to come out again, but that is, of course, Russia, but he didn't mention Russia by name. Now, the Mother of God did not ask for the world to be consecrated to heart. She asked for Russia to be consecrated to heart. Interestingly, the Russians know about Fatima, and they don't like Fatima at all, because they have possibly more faith in Fatima than many Catholics do. They know that the performance of the request of Fatima would mean the end of their power. Pope Pius XII, again in 1952, he had a kind of sort of consecration, but it wasn't what the Mother of God asked for. And so it didn't work. Again, Pope John Paul II, in 1982, after he was shot on the 13th of May, which is a great Fatima day, in 1981 in St. Peter's Square, and he recovered almost miraculously from the wound. I think in 82, 83, and 84, he made three successive sort of consecrations, but again, he didn't get together all the bishops of the world. He did not give orders to all the bishops of the world, and he did not consecrate Russia. And the Pope may say, well, I couldn't do it because the bishops would simply disobey me because they don't believe in Fatima, because they don't believe Russia needs consecrating, whatever. Well, whether or not Pope John Paul II can get the bishops to do what he wants or what he asks, the fact of the matter is that in three shots, he still hasn't done what the Mother of God asked for, and therefore communism is continuing to advance.
There is somewhat of a mystery here again. In the 1950s, I think that Pope Pius XII could have had the bishops behind him, and yet the consecration was not performed.
That's right. Especially in the year 1950, in the year 1950, there had been, in the last few years, in the late 40s, a tremendous movement of Fatima devotion all over the world, with pilgrim statues of Fatima going all over the world, and great fervor of Catholic crowds to honor the Mother of God and express their love for her. The prestige of the papacy was higher than ever. And in 1950, there was a Marian year, and the Pope made the definition of the Assumption, the dogmatic definition of the dogma of the Assumption of the Blessed Virgin Mary into heaven. And around that time, it's known that God showed to the Pope, Pius XII, personally, I think four times the miracle of Fatima. He saw in Rome four times the miracle of Fatima. That was around the time he was defining the Assumption of the Mother of God. But still, he didn't make the consecration that was asked for. He might at that point, if ever, have swung it because of the prestige of the papacy, because it was still close enough to the war for the bishops to have some soberness and good sense about them. The more they plunged into the peace of the 50s and 60s, the crazier they became, the more corrupted by the world. But in 1950, they were still somewhat sobered. That was the moment, if ever, and it's thought that somebody got to Pope Pius XII with some dubious counter-evidence against Fatima, and the Pope must have hesitated, and he who hesitates is lost, and he didn't make the consecration, and then for the rest of his reign, he didn't make it, and so not even the Pope of Fatima, as he liked to think of himself, Pope Pius XII, not even the Pope of Fatima made the consecration that was asked for.
What has been the consequences of our failure to heed the request of Our Lady on this matter?
The continuing spread of communism, the triumph of communism in one country after another, and the powerlessness, the absolute powerlessness of even the best of men to stop communism. Because you have some very good men who do their best to slow communism down or stop it, and they devise all kinds of decent means and good means and human means to stop Fatima, to stop communism. But the one thing they don't do is resort to the means of Fatima, or the Pope doesn't, and so nothing happens. Communism just continues to advance, and the devil takes over. The 50s were a still reasonably sane decade, although the termites were already in the woodwork. But with the death of Pope Pius XII in 1958, and the arrival of John the 23rd, and then Vatican II, and you have the diabolical 60s and 70s with the Beatles and rock music and craziness of all kinds, and abortion, the loss of the mass, collapse of the church. You just have a most incredible series of spiritual disasters and physical and material disasters, and the continuing advance of communism, and that's still the pattern in the 1980s.
Let's go back to the Second World War. We had the miracle of the sky in January of 1938.
Yes, that was the sign that Our Lady spoke of in the second secret that I was quoting a few moments ago. When you see a night lit up with an unknown light, realize that it is the great sign that God is giving that he's going to punish the world for its crimes. And that was that extraordinary aurora borealis. It was as though the sky was on fire, great flames in the sky. It wasn't an aurora borealis. It was a bit like it maybe, but it was quite clearly unusual, completely unusual. And this great red light, this flaming light, lit up the sky over the whole of Europe for, I forget, maybe it was a couple of hours on end. In January evening in 1938, that was the sign that God was going to punish the world for its crimes, and the terrible war, the terrible Second World War, broke out soon after that.
And how is the Second World War to be viewed in the context of Fatima?
It's interesting. The second secret of Fatima says something very interesting. It says, if men do not cease offending God, then under the reign of Pius the 11th, a worse war will start. The second secret had begun, if men do what I'm going to say to you, many souls will be saved and there will be peace. The war will come to an end. But if they do not cease offending God, then under the reign of Pius the 11th, a worse war will start. Now the strange thing is that it seems as though Our Lady got it wrong, because the war didn't start under Pius the 11th, the war started under Pius the 12th. The war was declared, broke out in September of 1939 by when Pius the 12th was Pope. So that's one reason why people say, well, Our Lady got it wrong and Fatima is not authentic. But the truth of the matter is that you could definitely say that the war broke out while Pope Pius the 11th was still the reigning pontiff, and it broke out in effect when Russia and Germany signed a pact, a non-aggression pact, which Russia deliberately did in order to liberate Hitler to fight the Western democracies. Because what Russia calculated was that once the German nationalists and the Western democracies have fought one another to pieces, then Russia will be able to come into a gravely weakened Europe and pick up the pieces. And that is actually exactly what happened. And hence, Our Lady was not wrong. The war did start under Pius XI, and what took place under Pius XII, the declaration of war, was simply coming out into the open of what already happened under Pius XI. And the real villains of the peace, clearly, are the Russians, the Bolshevik Russians. And what Fatima tells us, then, is that the real enemy is Russia, Bolshevik communist Russia. Our Lady appeared in 1917, just when the revolution was breaking out, the communist revolution was breaking out in Russia. And it's the Russians who have been deceiving the world and misleading it ever since. And it says, Our Lady of Fatima confirms what a little common sense and knowledge of history tells us, that the gulag of the Russians is far worse, far more numerous, far more criminal. Millions and millions killed, millions more killed, something like 60 million killed in the gulag of the Russians. It's a few million maybe in the concentration camps of the Nazis. The whole picture is that Nazi Germany is not nearly so sinful or so harmful to the human race as communist Russia.
We have the second phase of Ostpolitik then, beginning in the 1960s, and a main event there is the Rome-Moscow Agreement of 1962. What is this agreement, and what have the results of this agreement been?
Yes, that's true. After Pius XI, there was Pius XII. Now, Pius XII was much more strongly anti-communist right from the start than Pius XI had been. Pius XI finished anti-communist because at the end he understood there's no way of talking Turkey with communists. You don't ride the tiger, you shoot a tiger. You don't try to ride it or hold it by the tail. Pius XII understood that much better. And he was anti-communist right through to 1958. Then came John the 23rd, who again began to think he could talk with the communists, and he was pally with Khrushchev and so on. And then Pope Paul VI, who was the worst of all. And he established the Ostpolitik, which was the policy of getting on with the communists. And there was also had been, as you say, in 1962, the terrible Moscow-Vatican agreement. Details are known about it. And the agreement more or less was that the communists would refrain from persecuting the Catholic Church in communist countries just so long as the Church abstained from any further condemnations or criticism or attacking of communism. And that's why ever since 1962 there's been practically no public attacks by the Pope or by anyone else of either of communism or of its principles. That was one of the tremendous failures of Vatican II. There was a total failure at Vatican II to condemn communism. And the result is that while the persecution of the Church has in fact continued in the communist countries, the communists have been able to do as they like because their one great enemy, their spiritual enemy, the Catholic Church, the only enemy that the communists have to fear, that enemy has been silent and been like paralyzed. And that was the disastrous Moscow-Vatican Agreement of 1962, and that policy has been followed ever since. This policy of being nice to communists, being kind to communists, getting on with the communists, and it just doesn't work. And the people that really know that it doesn't work are the Catholics in these communist countries, and they have been betrayed. The true Catholics in all the communist countries, they could endure the persecution so long as they thought that Rome, so long as they felt Rome was behind them and supporting them. But Rome has betrayed those true Catholics in order to promote the false collaborator Catholics who collaborate with the communists and therefore, you know, don't properly defend the Church or the Church's interests or Christ's interests. They promote communism.
What happened to Cardinal Menzenti? He's an example of a cardinal who really stood up to communism.
Well, he was promised by Pope Paul VI that if he would quit the American embassy in Budapest and come back to the West, he would still remain Cardinal Primate of Hungary. And so he came back to the West, and when he got back to the West, Pope Paul VI stripped him of his primacy of being Cardinal Primate of Hungary. The promise, Pope Paul VI made him a promise to get him out of Hungary, where he was a figurehead and a tremendous symbol of true Catholic resistance to foul communism, to satanic communism. And the moment Pope Paul VI had got him back to the West, Pope Paul VI ratted on his promise. And Pope Cardinal Menzenti was betrayed. It was a terrible betrayal. Cardinal Menzenti more or less kept silence about that betrayal. I mean, he didn't attack the Pope, but he had every right to, because he was in fact terribly betrayed. Always in the name of the Ostpolitik, of being kind to the communists, being nice to the communists. Because the communists said to the Pope, you've got to get Menzenti out of Hungary. He's a tremendous symbol of resistance to us. We don't want him here. You get him out. And so Pope Paul VI tricked him out.
Finally, we have the third secret of Fatima, which Rome has never disclosed. And before we discuss what's in this secret, we should examine some of the details of how it has been written down.
The story of the third secret is very interesting. Lucy revealed the second secret at the time of the apparitions back in 1917, and also the first secret was known, the vision of hell. But the third secret, she said then, she wasn't allowed to reveal. And it's only chance references which give us a clue as to what's actually in it. But it was kept in her head by Lucy until the 1940s. And then I think it was in 1941, she was encouraged to write it down or told to write it down. She said, I will only write it down if I get an express order from my bishop. So finally the Bishop of Fatima, Leiria, which is the Bishop of Fatima, gave her the written order to write it down. And then she had a mysterious illness for a few months. She was incapable of doing anything. She could not write it down. She physically could not. And she continued to pray intensely to the Mother of God, and then I think the Mother of God appeared to her, and she was at last able to write it down. The envelope with the secret was then handed to the local bishop, who kept it in his safe, who probably didn't read it. It's just sort of half a page of writing in an envelope. It's not very long. It was kept in the safe, and it remained in the safe until the late 1950s, when Rome asked the bishop to send the secret to Rome. So that was under Pius XII, and the secret came to Rome. Now, the Mother of God had told Lucy that the secret could be revealed at any time, the third secret could be revealed at any time, or by the latest in 1960. By the latest in 1960 is what Our Lady said to Lucy. But when the secret reached Rome, Pius XII did not read the secret, is thought. He had it on his desk, he kept it in his office, but he didn't read it. Then when Pius XII died, everybody was talking about 1960. There were great hopes that the secret would come out in 1960. John the 23rd read the secret. He read it with a number, together with a number of his high-up officials and prelates. There was maybe a group of seven of them. They held a meeting. They decided what they were going to do about the Fatima, the third secret, and the decision was to hide it away, to not reveal it. And so the world was told a great lie, namely, Rome told a great lie, that the secret was under the control of the Pope. That's Our Lady gave the Pope the right to control the secret, which is not true. It was not entrusted to the Pope by Our Lady. It was entrusted to the local bishop in Fatima. And he could have read it and he could have divulged it. He didn't, but he could have done. And according to Our Lady's wishes. And Rome, instead of saying that 1960 was the latest that it could be revealed, Rome pretended that 1960 was the earliest that it could be revealed. That what heaven wanted was the Pope to reveal it at any time after 1960 that he saw fit. And so Rome refused to reveal it, and the result was that it's still not to this day being revealed.
Where's the secret kept? Is it kept in Rome?
Today it's certainly kept in Rome, yes. The piece of paper that Lucy wrote on is kept in Rome. It's been read by Pope John Paul II, it's been read by Cardinal Ratzinger, it was read by Cardinal Ottaviani. The popes have all read it, the succeeding popes have read it, and their close collaborators, the most senior of cardinals, the most important of cardinals, under each pope have probably read it, and the decision has been stayed with so far to keep it in the drawer, not to bring it out and not to reveal it.
There have been some theories about what the third secret is about. One of the theories is that it concerns the end of the world. Another one is that it concerns a nuclear war. Does the evidence support these theories?
No, because Monsignor Alberto Cosme de Amaral, who is the present bishop of Leiria Fatima, on September 10th in 1984, made a statement in Vienna, and he said that the secret of Fatima does not announce the end of the world. He said, the secret of Fatima speaks neither of atomic bombs, nor of nuclear warheads, nor of Pershing missiles or SS-20 missiles. And this was a question and answer session taking place in the Great Hall of the Technical University of Vienna in September 10 of 84. And he went on, Its content concerns only our faith. To identify the secret with catastrophic announcements or with a nuclear holocaust is to deform the sense of the message. The loss of the faith of a whole continent is worse than the destruction of a nation, and it is true that the faith is continually diminishing in Europe. So there is a Bishop of Fatima who has also read the message, or who has worked out what the message contains if he hasn't read it, and he says it's not about nuclear war or disaster or the end of the world. It's about a crisis of the faith.
There we have one leak. Have there been any other leaks about the content of the third secret?
Another leak, for instance, there have been a few leaks. Another leak, for instance, is Cardinal Ratzinger. In 1984, Cardinal Ratzinger gave an interview to an Italian journalist, and they spoke about the third secret of Fatima, and the journalist asked the Cardinal if he'd read the secret, and the Cardinal said, yes, I've read it. And the Cardinal made then, he made in 1984 a few remarks about the secret. And the most interesting of these remarks says the same thing, namely, the third secret is a basic appeal to convert, and it speaks of the absolute gravity of this moment in history. It speaks of the perils menacing the faith and life of the Christian, and hence the faith and life of the world. And then it also speaks of the importance of the last times. And that's what the Cardinal said in an interview in what was published in November 1984. Interestingly enough, that was a pre-published interview from the book that would appear a year or so later, June of 85. When the book appeared, those lines about the content of the third secret had been cut out. In other words, in his interview pre-published from the book, the Cardinal had given too much away about the third secret of Fatima. And when the final book appeared, the record was wiped clean of that particular remark, for instance. And clearly demonstrating Rome's anxiety not to give away what the third secret is about.
Should we be spreading information about what the third secret is about when Rome is keeping it hidden?
So long as the information is serious and reliable, definitely yes, because that was clearly the will of the Mother of God. And if the third secret is in fact about the crisis of faith in the Church, then obviously the Mother of God wants all Catholics to know that the faith is in crisis, and it's the Roman prelates who want the world not to know. The Roman prelates want the world to think that everything is hunky-dory and gung-ho and marvelous and peachy keen in the Church. They want the world to think that there's a great renew taking place, that their policies are marvelous, and so on and so on. And the Mother of God obviously thinks differently. And we've got to go with what the Mother of God thinks, and so we certainly ought to promote all that we know seriously about the content of the third message.
It is very interesting that Lucy has been silenced by the hierarchy.
Yes, that took place in the 1950s when Rome knew that the secret of Fatima would have to be sat on. Rome guessed, Rome got hold of the secret and found what it was about. And I mean, it would have been useless bottling up the secret in Rome and then having Lucy tell everyone what it was about. So under obedience, Lucy has been made to keep quiet about the third secret ever since. On the other hand, there are just flashes here and there in letters of Lucy and interviews of Lucy which indicate the same point, namely that the third secret is actually about the crisis of faith in the Church.
Yet many people are skeptical when you bring up information about the third secret. Many individuals simply do not believe that any information could be available.
Well, that's reasonable because, for instance, in 1963 there was published a bogus version of The Secret which spoke about the oceans dancing and the oceans hissing and the mountains dancing. It was a picture of an apocalypse, of a nuclear catastrophe and so on. And that's apparently not what the Secret is about. It's certainly unwise to promote false ideas of what the Third Secret of Fatima is about. On the other hand, Cardinal Ratzinger is a serious man. He's not a liar. At any rate, so far as one understands. And when he, in that interview with the journalist, said that it's about the perils, the threatening our faith, you know, that's something you can rely on. The cardinal may not have realized that what he was giving away, as I say, in the book version, he tried to cover up, but what he said there and what other hints that we've got from here and there and also from Lucy, they all add up to the same thing, that this is what the secret is about. And if it is, then there's every reason to get people to know, because people need to be told, the poor sheep blindly following these terrible shepherds of Vatican II, the poor sheep need to be told that these shepherds are misleading them, and they're being set on the road to hell.
What has been revealed about the third secret officially is its context. What is the context of the third secret?
Well, the context of the third secret is that it's preceded immediately by the second secret, and then we know from one of the letters of Lucy of Fatima, the second secret, you may remember, it finished, "Otherwise Russia will spread errors throughout the world, provoking wars and persecutions against the Church. The good will be martyred, the Holy Father will have a great deal to suffer, many nations will be annihilated." Then we know, Lucy goes on, or went on, the third secret begins, "In Portugal the dogma of the faith will always be preserved."
That implies that the dogma of the faith will not be preserved in other countries.
Correct. That's the sentence before the third secret, and then we also know how the whole message of Fatima ends, namely, "In the end my Immaculate Heart will triumph, and a period of peace will be given to the world." So, what precedes the third secret is the dogma of the faith will always be preserved in Portugal. What follows the third secret is, "In the end my Immaculate Heart will triumph." Those two statements alone suggest that in between, other countries will lose the dogma of the faith, and there's going to be something terrible that happened, but in the end my Immaculate Heart will triumph. That the context suggests some very grave disaster, if you like. And since the sentence before speaks of the dogma of the faith, it could easily be a disaster of the faith. So that's one thing we know for certain about the content of the third secret. There's another thing that we know for certain, and that is that whatever the secret prophesied, it's been going on being fulfilled ever since 1960. And of course, now since 1960, we have a terrible disaster of the Church. A third thing that we know for absolutely sure and certain about the secret is that the churchmen didn't want to reveal it. Now, if Our Lady had said that, you know, what the churchmen have in their mind is absolutely right and I approve and I encourage them, then of course the churchmen would have revealed it. On the other hand, if what she said was the Church is about to set out on a great disaster, of course you can very well understand the churchmen hiding it. So we know for certain the churchmen have hidden it, suggests that it doesn't exactly speak in the favor of what they've been doing for the last 20 years. And so then another fact that we know about the third secret is the circumstances under which it was written, namely Lucy's great difficulty in putting pen to paper, in penning it on paper. And that, again, was perfectly understandable if we think that Lucy had, as a devout nun, and a devout and obedient nun, had the greatest difficulty putting on paper that heaven was saying that the prelates and churchmen are going to lead the Church into a disaster. Her repugnance would be perfectly understandable if that's what it was about. Her repugnance is absolutely certain. This repugnance is easily explained if that's what the content of the message was. So there we've got some absolute certainties which all easily tie in with the content of the third secret being a disaster of the faith.
Hasn't Frère Michel in France done an exhaustive study of the third secret of Fatima and has the details about the content of the secret?
Yes, he has made a considerable study, and he's synthesized, from everything we know, he's synthesized a text which would cover approximately what the third secret covers.
Do you want to read that?
This is what Brother Michael of the Holy Trinity has put down as his summary of the contents of the third secret. "While in Portugal the dogma of the faith will always be preserved, in many nations, perhaps throughout the entire world, the faith will be lost. these shepherds of the church will fail gravely in the duties of their functions. Through their fault, consecrated souls and Catholics in great number will let themselves be deceived by the pernicious errors spread everywhere. It will be the time of the decisive combat between the Virgin and the devil. A great wave of diabolical disorientation will flow over the whole world. Satan will introduce himself up to the highest summits in the church. He will blind people's minds and he will harden the hearts of the pastors, because God will have handed them over to themselves as a punishment of their refusal to obey the requests of the Immaculate Heart of Mary. It will be the great apostasy announced for the last times, the false lamb, the false prophet, betraying the church to the benefit of the beast, according to the prophecy of the book of the Apocalypse.
Let's examine some of those statements. It refers to an apostasy, yet the bishops today argue that we're in the midst of a great renewal. How do you reconcile those two statements, and who is right?
The bishops are simply lying. There's no great renewal of the church. It is obvious from the fruits. Our Lord says you don't have to be great theologians. What our Lord says is you judge by the fruits. And the fruits of the so-called great renewal of Catholicism today are the universal destruction of the church. That's perfectly obvious. Many people, to take just one little example, many people go to communion in the most irreverent way, but very few go to confession. How many people have souls in a fit state to receive the body of Christ, to receive God himself? We may very well think very few. In the old days, plenty of people went to confession before they went to communion. Today, practically no one goes to confession before they go to communion. That's a pretty sure sign of bad fruits. And therefore, if the bishops say that there's a great and marvelous renewal of the church going on, they're lying. It's just not true.
Well, I think you also have to look at the hard statistical evidence. And there you see in many countries, especially in Europe, that vocations to the priesthood and to the sisterhood have dried up completely.
Yeah. That's another sure sign, vocations. And the vocations have dropped right off. There's absolutely no doubt about that. And the bishops can't pretend that, you know, the vocations are strong. There's no real proof of any real renewal, real spiritual renewal going on inside the Catholic Church. None at all.
So what you see here throughout the message of Fatima is that people have a great blindness. People are blind to the dangers of communism. People are blind to the collapse of the faith.
Yes. Yes, Our Lady tried to open our eyes, but we've not wanted to take heed of what she said. That's the tragedy of Fatima. She's told us, you know, how it is. She told us the score, but we haven't wanted to know. God mysteriously leaves us with our freedom. He respects our freedom, and if we don't want to know, he's not going to force it upon us. An interesting little point is that soon after the Church refused to reveal the secret, the third secret of Fatima, Our Lady appeared from 1961 to 1965, you may remember, in Garabandal in northern Spain. I think the apparitions, personally, I think the apparitions of Garabandal are true. Father O'Connor, Dominican father, I know doesn't, but I think they are true. And there, Our Lady said, many cardinals, bishops, and priests and are on the road to perdition and are taking many souls with them. So she was silenced. She was at Fatima. She came again at Garibaldi and told, said again, gave people in the second message at Garibaldi that guideline that the church is going gravely wrong. The churchmen are going gravely wrong, and they must not be followed.
Well, let's say if you don't like Garibandel, you can go to a church-approved apparition at La Salette, where Our Lady says that Rome will abandon the faith.
Yes.
And that there will be an age of great spiritual darkness.
There's a complete correspondence between the message of Fatima and the message of La Salette of 1846 in France. Yes, the two messages correspond. Rome will lose the faith and will become the seat of the Antichrist. The third message of La Salette is terrifying, but we're seeing it taking place under our eyes.
Now, Lucy has said that the third secret can be seen in the Apocalypse.
Yes, That Cardinal Ratzinger said the same thing, that it's all in Scripture. But that means you have to have a slightly detailed knowledge of the text of the Book of Revelation. The reference is to the false lamb, the dragon and the beast, then the false prophet, the false lamb, the beast. That's also the prophecies in Scripture of the great apostasy. That's in one of St. Paul's epistles. I think it's in the second epistle to Timothy. First must come, before the Antichrist comes, first must come the great apostasy, the great falling away. And there are these indications of Scripture concerning the end times, and Fatima, the third secret of Fatima, points out that these signs are now taking place, or will be taking place.
The third secret also refers to the great diabolical wave that is sweeping the world. What are some of the evidence of this great diabolical wave?
Look at abortion. Look at the triumph of abortion everywhere. I mean, look at the immorality, the filth, the lies, the confusion. Worst of all, maybe, the confusion and the loss of faith. I mean, Catholics just don't know which way to turn, and the confusion is getting worse day by day.
I think that's also a very important point, is the failure of the hierarchy and the pastors.
That's the gravest of all. How can the poor Catholic sheep know which way to turn when their pastors are all at six and sevens? And the Catholic hierarchy, many of them have lost the faith. They're certainly not leading Catholics in the faith. They're not leading them towards the faith. They're leading them into this kind of secular humanism, this Judaism. It's unspeakable, absolutely unspeakable, an unspeakable betrayal.
Now let's look at how the three parts of the secret relate to each other.
The first secret is basics, heaven and hell. And hell exists, and a lot of people fall there. And as Our Lady said, you've just seen a vision of hell. Many souls are falling into hell because there's no one to pray for them. And the little children learned, like no one's business, to pray for souls, that they may pray for sinners that they may not fall into hell. And little Jacinta made great sacrifices and did great penance in order to stop souls falling into hell, because she was so sorry for them when she'd seen them. That's basics. Then we move, if you like, into politics, and we see the threat of communist Russia, which took place from 1917 right through to 1967. But in 1967, something even worse took place, the aftermath of the Second Vatican Council, and the collapse of the Catholic Church, the collapse of the faith inside the Catholic Church. And that's the climax of the damnation of souls. It's the devil has never invented anything better than this present-day collapse of the Church in order to damn souls. It's also the climax of communism. Communism has triumphed when it has succeeded in so getting inside the Catholic Church that the Catholic churchmen are paralyzed. I mean, if the Catholic churchmen would get together and get their act together, as Americans say, if only they would get their act together, then they would get the Church together, and if they got the Church together, the Church would get the world together, and the world would turn right round. The whole situation would turn right round.
Then a theme of sadness seems to run throughout the Fatima message.
Yes, I know somebody who's been to Fatima and who noticed this sadness. You notice it also, of course, in the pictures of the little children, because the children, having seen hell, maybe because they're overwhelmed with the tragedy of souls being damned, and they're overwhelmed with the seriousness of the damnation of souls and the numbers of souls going to damnation. And they, from that point, the three little children do everything they can. But back of Fatima is this great tragedy, the tragedy of the modern world, the tragedy of men's blindness, of their losing the faith, of their letting communist Russia do what it will. Millions and millions of souls going to hell. That's what Fatima is about. It's the most gigantic tragedy. No wonder the little children are sad, and no wonder there's something sad about Fatima. But of course, I mean, Our Lady says, in the end my Immaculate Heart will triumph, so the situation is not without hope.
And it is in fact a very hopeful apparition, in that it will have a happy ending.
Yes. And today, many of us have to cling to that prophecy of Our Lady that in the end her Immaculate Heart will triumph. That is our great hope. Her heart is our hope. It's the last life belt that our Lord has thrown us on.
That is one way we can get through this present crisis.
Yes, by trusting in the Immaculate Heart of Mary, definitely. Because she has said she's not going to let us down. She doesn't speak in order to say nothing. And she's not going to let us down. And if she says that she's going to triumph, then she will triumph. It's as simple as that.
Now, what can Catholics do to hasten the coming triumph of the Immaculate Heart?
They can do what Our Lady said. And that is, firstly, practice, pray the rosary, do the duties of their state of life, and practice the devotion of the five first Saturdays. And then Catholics can also pray for the Pope and the bishops that they at last perform the consecration of Russia to the Immaculate Heart of Mary in a solemn act of reparation as Our Lady asked for. And in that way they will help to bring about the consecration, and that consecration will turn the whole situation around, and nothing else will.
So by living the message of Fatima, the laity can help the hierarchy to gain the grace to carry out this consecration.
Definitely. I think it was Padre Pio said that the consecration would be performed as when there were as many devotees of Fatima as there are communists. So by promoting Fatima, by encouraging people to pray the rosary, by praying it themselves, and by doing the five first Saturdays, that is a confession, communion, 15 minutes meditation on the mysteries of the rosary, and praying five mysteries of the rosary itself. By doing those four things on five first Saturdays, Catholics will do the most they can do to help bring about the consecration of Russia and the salvation of the Church and the salvation of the world.
Now, you are a member of the Society of St. Pius X, and I've noticed that the Society has done its best to carry out the message of Fatima.
Definitely.
Why did the Society of St. Pius X recently consecrate Russia to Our Lady's Immaculate Heart?
Well, as I say in the seminary letter, the Society couldn't do more and it couldn't do less. It couldn't do less because to make an official pilgrimage to Fatima, there were actually 50 of us priests there, 46, I think, from the Society with the Archbishop. And we couldn't do less because that's the least we could do. We could at least go down as priests and behind our bishop and have our bishop at least perform this consecration of Russia. Of course, it's not what Our Lady asked for, but it is an example to other bishops, and it's an example also actually to the Pope. This is what he should do. That firstly, and then secondly, it was the most we could do. It was the least we could do, and it was the most we could do. I mean, the Society can't force the Pope to do what Our Lady asked the Pope to do. It can't force other bishops to do what Our Lady asked the bishops to do. But it can do what it is capable of doing, and that's what the Society did. So we were there, and there were about 2,000 laity, 50 of us priests altogether, some 46 from the Society, the Archbishop, and we performed a consecration of of Russia to the Immaculate Heart of Mary. And I'm sure that it's an act which Our Lady is very grateful for, and which she will give the Society graces for. If the Society obtains a miracle of being approved today by Rome, which maybe the Society will obtain, maybe it won't, but if the Society does obtain approval from Rome, it will be a miracle, and that miracle may now be due to the fact that back in August we made that consecration to the Immaculate Heart.
Now, an important role that the Society is playing is in the preservation of the Mass. Has the new Mass been part of this apostasy that is told about in the Third Secret?
A very important part, because the new Mass de-Catholicizes the Catholic Mass. It takes everything out of the Catholic rite of Mass, which is most specifically Catholic, or it takes many of the things that are specifically Catholic out of the Catholic rite of Mass. And it's a halfway Protestantized and ecumenical Mass, which is like defusing. I mean, Catholicism is a time bomb, but the true Mass is a time bomb, an explosion of grace and power of God, of grace and divine power. But if you Protestantize and ecumenicize it, you defuse the time bomb, and it's a damp squib. And when the Mass is a damp squib, the very power in the Catholic Church is going to go off damply. There's no power and light. I mean, the Mass is like the uranium in the reactor of the Church. And if the mass is dampened down or strangled like the new mass does, then there's no power and light in the whole of the church. And the whole church is shutting down because of the strangulation of the mass by this miserable new rite.
Well, we see in the old mass that it was very clear that it was a sacrifice.
Yes.
And this is what sets, let's say, the Catholic mass apart from Protestant services. Now, in the new mass, you see most of the references to it being a sacrifice removed.
That's one of the main examples to illustrate that the new mass is utterly defective from a Catholic point of view. It's a disaster for the church. It dismantles the Catholic mass, and it dismantles Catholics. Catholics that regularly attend the Novus Ordo mass have, in their millions, lost the faith and become Protestants.
And in comparing the old mass to the new mass, I've done an analysis by simply laying the two side by side and comparing them. One notices that the references to Mary have mainly been deleted in the new mass.
Well, that's exactly what I'm saying. The dismantling of what's most specifically Catholic in the Catholic mass has taken place with the Novus Ordo mass. And when you dismantle what's Catholic, you're left with an unbeliever, with a Protestant, with an ecumeniac, with you've dismantled the Catholics. So Catholics are being disintegrating under the influence of, and the Catholic Church is disintegrating under the influence of the Novus Ordo mass.
Now, another issue which Catholics are grappling with is, let's say, apparitions other than Fatima. There's been a huge proliferation of various apparitions during the last couple of decades.
Yes. Well, Father O'Connor has done a good tape. In my opinion, he's done a good tape. The Dominican priest, I think, from Chicago, I don't know where he actually is stationed, he's done a good tape on Marian apparitions, and the only point I disagree with him is on Garibandel. I think Garibandel is genuine. I mean, one can always be wrong, but there's a great deal of evidence in its favor, of hard and objective evidence in its favor, and including the two messages and the appositeness and accuracy of the two messages, one in 1961 and 1965. But it's also true, of course, that wherever Our Lady intervenes genuinely, she gives the Catholic Church a tremendous boost and a tremendous help, and therefore the devil is bound to interfere, and the way in which he will interfere is to produce bogus apparitions which distract people and delude people. Two examples would have to be Medjugorje, which is charismatic and ecumenic. It's false. It's got to be false by the content of the messages, and also by the very inadequate behavior of some and lack of honesty on the part of some of the seers at Medjugorje. Also Bayside, which must be fraudulent. I mean, as to the visionary, it's fraudulent. Now, there are some good people that go there, and they say some good Catholic prayers, and so it really looks as though some of the fruits of Bayside are not bad. It looks as though there are some conversions that take place there. On the other hand, Bayside does tend to produce in people who follow it a somewhat naive and unbalanced attitude towards the Church's problems and so on. And at Bayside, you have certain absurdities like the dummy of the Pope, the dummy Pope Paul VI. So Bayside and Medjugorje are two examples of apparitions which are off the wall. But, as I say, people may go to Medjugorje. I've heard a tape of some of the singing at Medjugorje, which is beautiful, because the faith of the Yugoslavian people has been revived, and they do sing those marvelous hymns. So God is bound to give his grace where there is a demonstration of faith, and even these false places of apparitions do excite and arouse demonstrations of true faith. The people's faith is revived by these false apparitions because they don't yet know that they're false. And God must reward that prayer and penance that's done. So there are graces at these places of false apparitions, but there are, on the other hand, if you examine the message and examine the visionary, whoever it is, and what they say and what they do, you often find it's off the wall.
Now, let's conclude by taking sort of a snapshot again of Fatima. If one could put it in a nutshell, what is Fatima really all about?
It's about heaven and hell, the need of the Catholic faith for the conversion of sinners, the need of sinners to convert, the need of the Church to practice the devotion to the Immaculate Heart of Mary in particular, in order to obtain the grace of God to escape from the terrible conditions of our satanic 20th century, and in particular communist Russia, the advance of communism, and as we've seen from what we know of the Third Secret of Fatima, the need to be very leery or wary of what the present church leaders are doing, and the need to cling to what is being tried and true down the centuries of the Catholic faith, and to practice it and to live our Catholic faith. In one sentence, Fatima says we must live our traditional Catholic faith.
This discussion is necessarily brief. How can one obtain more information on the Fatima message and the Third Secret?
In English, I think the surest source of a good deal of further information is the magazine, which appears about once every 3 months, called the Fatima Crusader. There's an address, it's available in Canada, and there's an address in New York State in the United States. It's actually published each time Father Gruner succeeds in publishing hundreds of thousands of copies, and they go all over. It's fairly common to find it, but that is the most reliable extra source of additional and up-to-date information on everything connected with Fatima.
And of course that book by Frère Michel is also available from the Fatima Crusader.
It's available in French, and that of course is a tremendous book. It's in three volumes so far, and a fourth volume is due to appear, and most of what I've said about Fatima has come out of those three volumes. And it's a marvelous piece of work. It discusses the Third Secret, for instance, but it's so far only appeared in French. Now I think Timothy Tyndall Robertson in Devon in England is planning to produce an English version of some of the most interesting and important chapters, but the book he will produce will not be as long as the French. He has also already produced a pamphlet of a lecture of Frère Michel concerning the Third Secret, and that's appeared in English. He's planning, as I know, to produce a book containing parts of the French, three volumes. That would be very interesting and valuable as soon as it appears for English-speaking readers.
Thank you, Father.